This is the Saxo Market Call, the daily financial markets podcast, across asset classes and around the world.
Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It's Tuesday, 11th of April, 2023. We're back from a very long holiday weekend here in Denmark. If you did not get a chance to do so, please do check out the episode we put out last Thursday on generative AI, Peter and myself having a discussion about the whole space and the difficulty one has in trying to get exposure to it in terms of investable, in terms of the equity space, at least, because so much is in startups and venture capital. But it's a very interesting discussion. I hope you agree. But do have a listen to that special edition when you get a chance. All right, let's look at markets. So Friday we had a U.S. jobs report. It was pretty much on the soft side, really. If you look at a combination of factors, the private payrolls were weakest since December of 2020. We had earnings coming in at only 4.2% year-on-year, although we did see a pickup in the participation rate, and despite that, the unemployment rate dropping back to that cycle low, multi-decade low at 3.5%. U.S. yields popped a little bit when the markets had a chance to open on Monday, so yesterday, but I think it was probably that yield rise that saw equities selling off a bit, Peter. But by the end of the session, we have a sentiment stabilizing again. So it just doesn't feel like there's a really sense of alarm here. And we're perched at pretty interesting levels here. If we look at the S&P 500, that 4150 area on a closing basis for the future, and clearly that 4200 plus where we found resistance back in sort of January, February, the big focus here. And we have earnings season coming up. So I'm not sure what the market is waiting for, but there doesn't seem to be any sort of follow-on sense of alarm after the whole banking crisis, banking turmoil story.
No, exactly. I mean, we bounced back yesterday from that 4,100 level, as you said, quite beautiful. Third time in a row in a very short time span that we have rejected this price level. I think technically the market is leaning on the strong side here, and maybe momentum could extend. So, a close above that 4,150, as you mentioned, obviously key for that. It seems like the market is just there is not enough critical mass on either side to commit to, okay, a recession is coming, like Larry Summers is trying to muster up in his recent public appearances. And there doesn't seem to be maybe enough critical mass either to really go aggressive and saying, okay, the economy is reaccelerating. So we're stuck a little bit in this limbo, I think, maybe in the short term, or maybe the Q1 earnings. We'll talk a little bit more about that later in the podcast, but maybe these Q1 earnings can surprise to the upside. I don't think the expectations are very high for those, so maybe the bar is set low enough for us to get a bunch of good headlines. But I think at the end of the day, not so much the Q1 earnings, it's the outlook, and even more importantly, as we've talked about endlessly in some of our podcasts and equity notes as well, it's the cracks that are emerging in the banking system, it's the cracks that are emerging in the commercial real estate sector, and especially everything tied to credit conditions and the refinancing. It's that is really the key thing. And we had a big round of refinancing here in Denmark on April 1st. A lot of the homeowners, which are on very short-term adjustable mortgages, just got bumped up pretty significantly at 250 basis points from the previous refinancing round. So, and I wonder if other markets will experience the same type of refinancing, then it could really hurt with a lag. And I think that's the confusing part here.
Yeah, I agree. And then the problem is, we're all looking around trying to gauge the risk of some kind of systemic contagion risk, something that moves fast. But the tightening credit conditions are a slow-moving beast, probably. The long and lagging effects of tightening of policy, as you indicate, as that rolls into view, it just takes time. And markets are pretty impatient. So, yeah, getting the timing right here, I think, will be very critical across markets, and not least for FX and the dollar. And I think if we continue to see sort of tepid to okay data, we see yields sort of flattish, we see sentiment continuing to hope for the best, we could see the dollar continuing to roll over as other central banks are still, at least the ECB is still in tightening mode relative to the Fed, et cetera. And those are conditions for dollar weakness. You can only get dollar strength two ways, risk off, so bad news being bad news and fears of recession, and then the fight to sort of see when the policymakers are catching up with the downside risks to the economy, or as you talked about, the reheating sort of fear, the inflation reheating, the economy reheating, and that bringing more Fed tightening. And I think there's very little upside potential on that front. Yes, we could get another hot CPI print or two, the residual strength in jobs market, but not in a major new acceleration in terms of the upside for the Fed here. So where does it leave us? I think with a difficult path. But for the yen, quite as long as things are sentiment-wise are stable and yields are not declining here and the outlook is not immediately darkening, we do have path for more yen weakness in the year term. And we saw Ueda out in his first major appearance at a press conference yesterday with just essentially reaffirming continuity in Bank of Japan policy. And with the yields popping a little bit higher in the U.S. and elsewhere, we saw the yen, no big surprise, plus that press conference on the weak side. So you can see on slide 3 that dollar yen popping back there. It's nothing major until we start to see it challenging considerably higher, that 137.50 area in the 200-day moving average that stopped the rally back in March. But yeah, yen weakness, and if you look at euro yen, et cetera, you know, the dollar has weakened a little bit since yesterday. Euro yen is actually top of the zone here. So we're waiting for incoming data, and this week that's the two key points are that CPI data out of the U.S. tomorrow and the retail sales at the end of the week. But especially the CPI, I think, will be impactful for setting the lay of the land and determining where we go short term for the U.S. dollar. I did notice a little bit of Aussie residual strength overnight, popping back higher versus the Kiwi. There was that big story of the divergence in the two central banks, the RBA versus the RBNZ. That story hasn't gone anyway, but the sort of the downside, big sell off on that those two central bank meetings, essentially rejected now. If we stick above, let's say, 107, and maybe the news item overnight that Australia and China are ending, have found a friendly way to end the tariffs on barley, a sign of hope, a ray of hope for Australia there, and maybe a sense of normalizing relationship and the trade demand for Australian exports could pick up in other areas as well if this is a sign of more overtures from the Chinese side. Interesting one to watch there. All right, we had the big pop in crude oil recently, Ole, and we've just literally treaded water, done absolutely nothing since then. What's the next shooter drop here for the oil market to figure out if we can get some more traction?
Well, that's a very good question, John. I think this week some guidance hopefully should be provided by oil market reports from the three major forecasters. We got the EIA today, and then later in the week we got OPEC and IEA. Because what the market is somewhat perplexed about is the outlook for growth demand this year, which has been in the region of 2 million barrels. If you look in the insert there on slide 4, and the market is obviously now looking for a downgrade following the production cut that we saw from OPEC last week, simply in response as they see a weaker outlook than anticipated. So we'll see whether these two. Whether these can be tied together, and if not, if they still hold on to a strong belief in growth to be picking up, then obviously prices is at risk of moving higher later in the year. But I think in the short term, we talked about last week as well, there is this massive gap now down to $80 in Brent and around 80 in or 75 in WTI. And from a technical perspective, that these are rarely left alone. And last week, having jumped 6%, last Monday we settled within a 20 cent range the next 3 days. It just highlights the market has done most of the buying that they need to do at this time. And that buying was extremely aggressive last week. Just look at the insert there on slide 4, again, in the top right corner. We had the biggest amount of buying since December 2016. On Monday and Tuesday last week, and it just highlights how the market has been completely wrong-footed now. First by the banking crisis last month, which led to almost a record amount of selling within the 2 week period, and now the subsequent covering of shorts and a small addition of new longs. So the market is just somewhat whipsawed here, and I think there is potentially a risk that we may drift lower before we potentially have another look at the upside.
All right, and now we have the spring in the Northern Hemisphere, at least the spring rolling thoroughly into view here. Can't help but focus on agricultural markets. There's going to be a huge focus on wheat this year, as you're indicating on slide 5, I suppose.
Yeah, simply because we're coming into this season with a pretty dire conditions in the across the U.S. Wheat growing fields. We have conditions rated good to excellent, falling to 27% last week. That's simply, it's a record low. I think it was more or less tied with what we saw back in 1996, but really a very bad condition for this time of year. And most of the damage has been done in the region around Kansas. It's a state that provides 25% of the U.S. winter wheat and 17% of the total U.S. wheat production. The bone dry conditions there is really hurting the crop, and that's the reason why we're seeing the spread between Chicago wheat, which is the one we normally talk about, and Kansas wheat being driven to a record high, the spread between the two. So this is where we focus. The report today is not one of the big ones, but there is some expectation for downgrade to stock levels in U.S. stock levels of corn and soybeans, but also a continued focus on Argentina, where also dry conditions has led to significant downgrades, both corn and soybean output.
All right. Key season coming into view for agriculturals. Back over the equity market, Peter, we have the earnings season kicking off, as you indicate on the earnings slide on Friday, with the big banks in the U.S. reporting, but a couple other interesting stories out there. And then you have this interesting focus you had this morning in our internal call on Japanese equities and a signal that their valuation is looking attractive with Berkshire Hathaway moving in.
Yeah, if we start with the big news first, of course, was the preliminary Q1 earnings releases from Samsung and TSMC, two very large semiconductor manufacturers out of Asia. And then Samsung saw its profitability plunge by 95%, so back to 2009 levels. They're also cutting their memory chip production. They're doing that to restore pricing. And you know, basically slim down inventory levels, and this is exactly what the Micron Technology CEO said recently, that this is what is needed from the big players: restraint to restore pricing and profitability. So Samsung is moving along with that, and then TSMC, which is a foundry business, basically produces semiconductors for all types of businesses and purposes, applications around the world. They missed their sales estimates, and basically demand overall still remains a little bit tepid here. So not exactly the kind of data points you want if you are leaning towards a reacceleration in the economy. And then Japanese equities, as you say, put in here the Nikkei 225 futures, continuous futures on slide 6. Not a particularly rosy, strong momentum story there for almost, 2 years, at least priced in Japanese yen. So Berkshire Hathaway is the driver of this story. So maybe the listeners on this podcast, all the way back to the early days of the pandemic, will recognize that we told the story that Berkshire Hathaway acquired a significant holdings, I think more than a 5%, across a group of five physical commodity trading firms in Japan. And that was really, really great timing. So I think a lot of these stocks are up 5-6x since then. So that has been a very good investment for Berkshire Hathaway. And they are launching right now a seven-layer tranche yen bond sale, and they're using those issuances and financing in yen to acquire. They have said that acquire more Japanese equities. They've already increased it to 7.4% from 5%, and they want to increase it more. And as I said in the internal call, if you look at the Japanese equity market, it's priced at a 60% discount to U.S. equities. The dividend yield forward, 12-month forward, is 2.7%. I think that's a little bit higher than the S&P 500. So, or at least at par with the S&P 500. So I think it's new times for Japan. And then they're in net debt, so they have more cash than debts. The net debt is negative, and that means actually the Japanese equities, and probably one of the few equity markets out there in the world that, in aggregate terms, has a positive sensitivity to rising interest rates. So that's an interesting shield, I think, in this this environment with high interest rate refinancing and inflation. And then another single story, which is a little bit of a mirror image of what we just said on semiconductors. Apple is confirming that its PC shipments are down 41% compared to a year ago. And of course, Apple is hit harder than Dell, HP, etc., because they are higher priced consumer electronic goods, and a lot of consumers around the world are hurting from these high inflation. So those are the stories that we're tracking today. And then, of course, as you mentioned, John, it's all about the earnings season. On slide 7, the big finale this week will be on Friday, with JP Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, and Citigroup being the three most important ones, kicking off the U.S. banking earnings season for Q1. A lot of focus on JP Morgan Chase. The net revenue growth rates are expected to be quite solid in a year-on-year basis. I think JP Morgan is expected to grow net revenue by 18% compared to a year ago. But it's not so much about, you know, earnings per share and net revenue. It's really about what is the loan growth outlook from these banks and what are they seeing in terms of the funding situation. Jamie Dimon, we said that last week on the podcast, Jamie Dimon said that, you know, the banking crisis will continue to linger for some time here. It's not over yet. And I think that's a very powerful message then there in his shareholder letter. And two other names we're highlighting on Thursday, Tesco on an inflation focus in UK, and then Delta Airlines and on you know, travel, business traveling and leisure activity in the US, but also you know, flying abroad. And then the little insert I've put in here on slide 7, it's basically showing the 12-month forward earnings. And what I wanted to highlight there, the blue one is the 12-month forward. The red one is looking 12 months more into the future. So that's, you know, 48 months into the future. And what you can see about from the blue line is that we've actually seen analysts raising their earnings estimates for the 1 year ahead, despite the banking crisis and tighter credit and some mixed economic data. I think it's an interesting takeaway. I don't think equity analysts per se are very good at, you know, incorporating macro conditions. So, but it gives you an idea of, you know, the brewing positive sentiment that we're seeing in equities.
Yeah, you said 48 months ahead, and I know you meant 24 months. I just wanted to correct that for...
Sorry.
So the year ahead and then the year beyond that for the two lines there on that chart.
Exactly.
Okay, let's roll forward to the rest of this week's macro calendar. We have three of the regional U.S. Fed presidents that are voters this year speaking late today. Keep that in mind. We also have the FOMC minutes tomorrow. I haven't really highlighted that. I probably should have, but are we going to see really dramatic new revelations relative to what their likelihood of doing something in May 3rd is? I'm not so sure. I think it'll depend, of course, on the incoming data, but as well on financial conditions themselves. So if things are very calm and equities are posting new highs, I think that's almost enough, as long as you don't have any massive shocks in the data and there's hardly any data left until that meeting that weighs much. I think they'll be very happy to move that 25 basis points. That is about 70%+ priced in at this point for the May 3rd meeting. We also have some treasury auctions, watching the demand there at the, you know, as we recently touched sort of these low levels, lowest levels for the cycle, 3-year today, 10-year tomorrow, 30-year on Thursday. And the CPI really tomorrow, I think, is the key data point of the week, with a secondary importance, that retail sales data point on Friday. All right, still trying to find our feet after 5 days off, but let's see where things stand after another day's action, and we'll be back tomorrow with the next Saxo Market Call.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter @SaxoMarketCall or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.